This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. The House Judiciary Committee has filed court papers that suggest the panel might recommend additional articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The House Judiciary Committee is keeping open the possibility of additional charges as it pressed a federal appeals court to order testimony from former White House counsel Don McGahn. The committee is investigating potential obstruction of justice by President Trump during special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. The Justice Department has asked the appeals court to dismiss the request, saying it's less urgent now since the House has already moved ahead with articles of impeachment, even without the testimony of the former White House lawyer. Arguments are scheduled to be heard early next month. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Boeing's CEO is resigning amid ongoing problems at the company over the troubled MAX 737 aircraft. The Chicago manufacturer said Monday that Dennis Muilenburg is stepping down immediately. The board's current chairman, David Calhoun, will officially take over on January 13th. The board said a change in leadership was necessary to restore confidence in the company as it works to repair relationships with regulators and stakeholders. The MAX was grounded worldwide in March after the second of two crashes of its jet, killing a combined total of 346 people. The leadership change follows Boeing's announcement last week that it would halt MAX production in January. The U.S. military has announced that a U.S. service member was killed in action Monday in Afghanistan. In making the announcement, the U.S. forces Afghanistan did not provide further details. The Taliban, in a statement, claimed the U.S. casualty occurred in the volatile northern Kunduz province. The insurgent group said it targeted Afghan and American soldiers with a roadside bomb. This is VOA News. A court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced five people to death and three others to prison in connection with last year's killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. AP's Matt Small has more.
Saudi Arabia's state-run TV says a court there sentenced the five to death for last year's murder of the journalist at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Three others were sentenced to prison. All can appeal the verdicts. The trials of the accused were carried out near total secrecy, although a handful of diplomats, as well as members of Khashoggi's family, were allowed to attend. In all, 11 people were on trial for his death. His body has never been found. Matt Small, Washington.
With talks between the United States and North Korea at a stalemate, North Korea has been warning about an upcoming Christmas gift. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
That so-called Christmas gift, says Heritage Foundation's Asia expert Bruce Klingner, could be an intercontinental ballistic missile test.
They could jump right to that or a nuclear test, but it's also possible they may sort of go more incrementally up the escalation ladder by doing medium-range tests, intermediate-range missile tests, a space launch vehicle, which is sort of a civilian version of an ICBM, before they jump to the ICBM.
And it may not be on Christmas.
We're looking to the annual New Year's Day speech by the North Korean leader for further clues. So I think there may be an overfixation on the phrase Christmas present. I think it was more rhetorical than literal.
Shelley Adler, Washington.
Rising space power China has attacked the newly created U.S. Space Force, calling it a direct threat to outer space peace and security. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley reports.
China's foreign minister says its country is deeply concerned about it and resolutely opposed to it. It says the move violates an international consensus on peaceful use of outer space and would undermine stability and the global security balance. China's space program has advanced rapidly since its first crewed mission in 2003. In a report last February, the Pentagon said China and Russia have embarked on major efforts to develop technologies that could allow them to disrupt or destroy American and allied satellites in a crisis or conflict. I'm Zaria Shackley.
An American tourist burned in a volcanic explosion on New Zealand's White Island has died, raising the death toll to 19. ABC News reports Mayuri Singh died Sunday night in an Auckland hospital. Her husband, Pratap Singh, remains hospitalized. There were 47 people on White Island when the volcano erupted December 9th. It killed 13 people initially and left more than two dozen others hospitalized with severe burns. The bodies of two victims have not been recovered, and authorities say they were likely washed out at sea and may never be found. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, sitting in for James Buddy, who's on vacation. Today is Tuesday, December 24, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Algeria's longtime military chief has suffered a fatal heart attack, raising questions about the country's future amid ongoing protests for change.
I don't expect it to impact the overall trends, both on the regime side or the protest side, because we've just had an election where one of Gaid Salah's closest political allies, Tebboune, was elected president in a highly boycotted election.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University. Uganda's main opposition party says it will proceed with plans to meet with members in towns and villages despite a police order. And other activists in Uganda have relaunched a campaign against corruption. In Eswatini, a court plans to hear a petition beginning today that wants police to return property that was seized from political activists who were detained for questioning last week.
It's an orchestrated systemic designed to silence the voices of dissent.
That was Jan Sitholi, leader of the opposition Swazi Democratic Party. We'll also have the second in our five-part series on China's growing presence in Africa coming up on Daybreak Africa. The sudden death of Algeria's longtime military chief, Lieutenant General Ahmad Gaid Salah, is the latest shock this year to an entrenched political system that is trying to hold on to power while providing enough change to satisfy a very persistent protest movement. The protest helped bring down longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika in April. Gaid Salah, who died yesterday from a heart attack, essentially guided the country toward an election that brought a member of the established leadership to power while allowing the protest to continue. Now, the country is essentially holding its breath to see which path it will take. I talked with William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University, about the possibilities for the future.
Well, it will probably calm the game for some period. There's 3 days of national mourning and a week of army mourning following the death of the Algeria's strongman. And so, you know, both sides will keep their powder dry and respect a certain period of respect for the dead. It's one of the reasons why Algeria took so long to turn the page after Bouteflika's debilitating heart attack, you know, out of respect for, you know, this statesman of another time. But I don't expect it to impact the overall trends, both on the regime side or the protest side, because we've just had an election where one of Gaid Salah's closest political allies, Tebboune, was elected president in a highly boycotted election.
So what about the new guy? He is clearly going to be seen as part of the old guard, and that's what the protesters have been trying to get rid of.
Yeah. Now, we have a new army chief being named who's from the east and is not really connected to, let's say, the corrupt ways of the army. So it'll be interesting to see whether the new army chief has a little bit of a honeymoon period. He's sort of a strategy guy, an infantryman, and not really connected to, let's say, the army deals and other aspects of the military, which tend to provoke the protesters. But the new president hasn't really captured the imagination of the general Algerian public or the protesting crowds. He has an opportunity to make good with the protesters. For example, he could release all the leaders that have been arrested in recent months or lift other controls on freedom of expression or freedom to protest. But so far, the gestures made by the new president have been fairly symbolic. For example, he's asking the population to call him Mr. President rather than Your Excellency, as if that was a major concession to the protesting crowds.
So what are their signs should we be looking at?
Well, most of the analysis tends to point at the fact that we've had millions of Algerians in the street for 10 months, which is true, except that there have been ebbs and flows in the protesting, and the largest protests have occurred around national anniversaries or international events like International Women's Day, when you'll get those larger protests. So if you sort of want to take the temperature of what's going on, you look, you know, let's say over the next 2-3 months at any sort of major national anniversaries. And if you're still getting 1 million people in the streets of the various cities, 2 million people, that means the protest movement still has a lot of legs. But if that starts to wane, if the crackdown seems to be working, if the protest crowds are smaller, then we're probably seeing the beginning of the end of this round of protest.
Do you think that there is a point, if this continues, that the regime might say enough and take stronger action?
Yeah, I think it's just a question of what concessions they're willing to make. So far, we've had Bouteflika's presidency end, and we've had arrests of a number of close allies to Bouteflika for corruption, but not all of the people that could have been arrested for corruption, and former intelligence chiefs and prime ministers and others. But it wasn't a sort of a systematic crackdown. It was more of a selective crackdown that looks to outsiders a little bit like certain parts of the regime settling scores with other parts of the regime. I think the one that's the most likely, if we have sustained protests, would be bringing back some of the ministers and government officials who presided over Algeria's first democratic opening in 89 to 91, figures like Hamrouche and other ministers that work for him, who so far have been staying out of the political discussion, but could be returned if Algeria is going to take a second try at serious democratization.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University. In Eswatini, a high court in the capital, Mbabane, plans to hear a petition beginning today. It seeks to compel the police to return all property that was seized from political activists, including cell phones, tablets, computers, flash drives, and documents belonging to the political party's assembly in Swaziland, known as the PPA. Citing an investigation into issues of national security, police detained and questioned political activists, civil society leaders, and leaders from the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland for hours last week. Critics say the move was aimed to intimidate, harass, and thwart demands for democratic reforms. Jan Sithole, leader of the opposition Swazi Democratic Party, says all trade union groups, banned political parties, and civil society organizations have been invited to the court to show solidarity. He tells VOA's Peter Claudy that arbitrary arrests were illegal and contravened the kingdom's constitution.
Today, Tuesday, we have already petitioned the government because we feel this is an attack to our freedom of expression and the voices of the people, because they have selected only the leadership of all political parties that are in a political assembly, who have been assigned and mandated by the general populace from different political divides to demand for a dialogue with the monarchy so that they can deal with the issues of democratization in Swaziland.
But the police say that the reason why they called all of you in for questioning was because they were investigating issues of national security. Why are you displeased with that?
We believe that is true, but the manner in which this particular attack and onslaught on the rights of the people, particularly the voice of the voiceless, which are the leadership, it's an orchestrated systemic design to silence the voices of dissent. Because all of us are citizens of this country. We've been here for as long as we were born. Why is it that on one particular day, all of us in the morning, simultaneously in our houses, attacked and dispossessed of our properties that include private information, banking information, for no apparent reason? And in fact, there is a lot of unprecedented way this particular search warrant has been written, because it doesn't matter whether you are a political leader or a labor leader. It was just one size fits all in terms of everything that was required, and it did not even specify what is it that they want to search in the house. But it is just a broad application that was granted clandestinely because we were not alerted that they had gone to court because we were resisting anything, because we were not even alerted.
I understand one of the reasons why you went to court is to ensure that the court orders the police or the security agencies to hand over your seized property. Do you foresee this happening since this is a matter of national security?
Well, I believe that if we have fair justice, then we believe we should. We're actually interdicting this order and demanding that our properties come back.
Jan Sitoli is the leader of the opposition Swazi Democratic Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. And Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC, says it will go ahead with plans to meet with its members in towns and villages despite a police order it not to. In a letter to the opposition, the police reminded party leaders that meetings with members should be held in an enclosed building in accordance with public management order. The letter further cautioned the party not to hold any public gatherings. But the opposition says the letter is yet another attempt by the government to use state institutions to thwart its efforts to mobilize and meet its members in the run-up to the next general election. Supporters of the governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM, backed the police for carrying out their constitutionally mandated duty to enforce the laws and maintain law and order. They said the opposition party's defiance could plunge the country into chaos and violence. Patrick Oboy Amoriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the commercial capital, Kampala.
We decided as a national council that we'd go out to the countryside, organize the people beginning from the villages, elect our leaders, give people the opportunity to do this right from the grassroots. But this is now being inhibited by this new order from the police force, whom we wrote to inform him. By the way, under the law, we are just meant as a political party to inform the authorities about whatever activities we intend to take. We are not required to seek permission. For the police force to say to us, you are not going to have any activities outdoor, is like actually saying to us that you will not have any activity taking place.
What is your party going to do about this directive from the police? Since you said it restricts your ability to mobilize your members for party political activities in the run-up to the next general election.
One thing that needs to be understood is the fact that every little political space that we enjoy today in this country as a party has been fought for. It's not been given to us on a silver platter. And therefore, we as the FDC will go ahead with or without the clearance from the police, because we do not need any clearance. Even if these restrictions are there, we think that we'll carry out our activities.
If your party goes ahead with this plan of yours, aren't you going to put your members who will attend these meetings in jeopardy or in harm's way if the police decide to enforce the law?
When a number of our members are aware of the law, the confines of the law, and then as we have educated them in different fora when the opportunity provides, and so we feel that it is our duty to counter what the police has done. And we are going to do this through media pronouncements and also through our agents in the local communities to say to them, we are within the law, and that is the police that is violating our rights, which rights we have got to stand for. And so we're going to encourage them to defy what the police has said or has ordered. And we are just hopeful that they are able to marshal the necessary courage to come out of their homes to do the needful.
What do you say to supporters of the NRM who are of the opinion that they are operating under the same rules and that your decision to defy the police is a mark of irresponsibility which could plunge the country into chaos? Your response to that?
Not at all, because you see, for us, we do this peacefully. And if the police likes, as they have always done, they can, you know, go against the citizens of this country. But all we have said to them is that the day of reckoning will come.
Patrick Oboy Amoriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change. He spoke with VOA's Peter Claudy from the commercial capital, Kampala. And days after Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni participated in a demonstration to fight corruption, activists in Uganda have relaunched a campaign that they say will meet that goal. Called Black Monday, it is designed to sensitize citizens to shun corrupt officials. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rawakaringi files this report from Kampala.
In this campaign, activists are urging citizens to wear black clothes as a sign of the fight against corruption. They also want boycotts of businesses and enterprises owned by corrupt government officials. Xavier Ejoy works for Action Aid Uganda, one of the NGOs in this campaign. He says to deter government officials from profiting from corruption.
We want to make it risky for the corrupt. We want to isolate the corrupt. And we want to ensure that corruption is frowned upon by all citizens. When they come to church, they should not be given front seats. When they come to the mosque, they should not be given space to identify them prominently.
The campaign also calls on those who know about corruption to tell at least 5 people of the dangers associated with it. Ejoy says they also name and shame corrupt officials.
We will profile those stories and publish them in very innovative ways on a monthly magazine or newsletter that we will distribute across to citizens and so on different platforms, physical paper copies, but also on social media in different fora and so on that will distribute.
According to Transparency International, a group that assesses levels of corruption globally, Uganda is ranked at 149 out of 180 countries and is third in East Africa after Burundi, which ranks at 170, while South Sudan is ranked at 178 and is the most corrupt East African country. Rwanda, at 48, is the least corrupt East African country. Sise Kagaba is the head of Anti-Corruption Coalition Uganda, another NGO in the fight against corruption. She says the campaign is timely as the country heads toward the 2021 election campaigns.
Remember, we are going for elections, and there's a lot of commercialization of politics. So we want people to vote, people who are not buying them to vote for them, but people who have that clear message and clear manifesto that they're going to deliver services.
Activist Mariam Mwiza agrees. She says the government should punish corrupt officials.
Their minister, that they have been eating money, they have eaten everything, and they are still in the offices. They should be removed from those offices as soon as possible. Then the president would have now shown us that he is serious, ready to fight corruption.
Activists say Uganda cannot achieve its developmental potential if there is still rampant corruption. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
China has cemented its position as most African countries' biggest economic and political partner, but it is a complex and nuanced relationship. This week, we are broadcasting a series of reports by VOA's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg. Today, he looks at how Chinese technology and funding is helping Africa to broaden its access to the Internet. In Ethiopia, for example, China has offered the largest loan in the history of telecommunications in Africa, more than $3 billion. But critics say China's communist rulers are exporting a system to suppress dissent and control what people see online.
In 2008, Eugenio Gagliardone was talking with a telecommunications official in Addis Ababa.
When we were done, I started walking around, and, you know, it was the first time that I've been to that building. Opening a couple of doors, I noticed that the vast majority of people in this office were not Ethiopian engineers, but they were Chinese engineers.
That led the media studies academic at Johannesburg's Wits University to investigate China's growing involvement in Africa's information technology sectors. He has studied the often heard view that China enters Africa with the ideas and the technology and implements them as it sees fit.
This is actually not the case. I've seen seen a lot of leverage on the side of mostly African governments to develop very specific SDO information society that emerge from the local context.
Gagliardone explains that in countries where citizens have less democratic rights, China provides the authorities what's needed to restrict the internet. However, should countries where citizens enjoy more freedom want an unrestricted internet, China's experts install exactly that.
China has shown a great ability in fitting into the specific socio-technical, socio-political structure that are found in each individual country.
But an analyst at the International Media Freedom Group, Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, Cedric Alviani, thinks Beijing is trying to export what he calls its oppressive internet model.
They are promoting what they call the sovereignty over internet, which is a concept that allows a country's government to have any right they want to have over the internet in their country.
In China, the government censors the internet and blocks Western social media sites. It monitors citizens' activity online and has wired much of the country to a facial recognition and public monitoring system. It says the system prevents crime and terrorism, but critics say it's used to track dissidents. Chinese authorities say they manage communication to ensure stability and development. Alviani says the Chinese Communist Party's internet policy at home is to shut down criticism. Gagliardone has spent years studying Beijing's internet blueprint.
If we look at the content of the policy, it's simply saying each country should decide for itself about which type of internet is the best for its population, for its ideas of development and so forth. So it doesn't say China should be the example, but obviously it could be.
South African media studies professor Herman Wasserman says it's known that Beijing has provided internet surveillance technology to some African states. Media investigations have, for example, exposed how technicians from China's Huawei Corporation allegedly helped Ugandan and Zambian security forces intercept the communications of government opponents.
There have been instances where that has been noted, where signal blocking equipment, etc., were procured from the Chinese. It's very alarming, it's very worrying, but again, one has to ask the impetus, does that come from China or does that come from African governments? And so I think African governments...
Gagliardone says authorities in democratic countries also monitor the internet, not for social control, but to detect crimes such as child pornography and especially terrorist activity. He says when it comes to internet surveillance, African countries publicly line up with the terrorism concerns of Western powers.
We have seen a tendency in many countries in Africa towards restriction of freedom of expression or like blanket internet shutdowns, using the anti-terrorism agenda as a justification for restricting the information space.
Gagliardone says Western donors promised to fund information technology in Africa as far back as the 1990s, but never delivered. So China has stepped into the gap. The result, he says, has been relatively cheap internet access in many parts of the continent. Freedom of information advocates say Africans must maintain pressure on their governments to keep the internet open as an essential tool for social and economic development. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
That's it for this Tuesday, December 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features on a special Christmas show right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, wishing you will have a very good holiday week.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd. right here on Border Crossings.